And we are live just a couple minutes early today, and I've been late on so many things this week. Being a couple minutes early feels kind of good. Anyway, I've got our guest, Kevin, on, and he will be with us in just a moment. I met Kevin on Facebook, but he's actually been listening to the podcast for a very, very, very long time, all the way back to, like, back in those days when I used to drive around in the car and scream at people in my little Volkswagen Jetta, and we did the show remotely, or I should say mobily. And he also is a mushroom cultivator. And I was posting some stuff about mushrooms, and he had some thoughts on how much mushroom a person could grow in a small space like an apartment. I thought that was a great topic because I hear from you guys all the time, like, I don't have a lot of land. I have a little garden home. I have an apartment. I have a house, but I live in a Karen-filled HOA, and I can't do anything. And mushrooms, and this is something I've gotten very big into in the last about 4 or 5 months, are just an amazing source of nutrition and an incredibly valuable food source. And you can grow them in a space, you know, it's the footprint of a small closet. You could probably grow more than you'll ever eat. Now, if you want to grow larger than that and turn it into like a commercial operation or something, and Kevin is kind of small scale commercial, you need more space, right? But for one person, guys, I'm telling you, like one Martha tent can just produce more mushrooms than a typical family is going to want to use. And then it's not just you're producing food and medicine that is a very nutritious form of food and medicine. It is that you're producing expensive food and medicine. Last time I was at Albertsons, they had tons of the little white mushrooms and portobello mushrooms and baby bellas and brown, you know, they're all the same. They're all crap. They're cheap. They grow them in shipping containers in Pennsylvania. They had, you know, one thing that was fresh mushrooms outside of those things. And it was just simple blue oysters. And a 3.5 ounce package was $6.50. So figure out that by the pound. And you realize you're growing something that sells for the price of beef. And I've also said a lot of mushrooms lately. Like, if you say, I don't like mushrooms, you haven't tried enough mushrooms enough ways. Because, like, do you like crab meat? Well, then you might like lion's mane. Or, you know, if you like steak, you might like lion's mane cooked a different way. I'm just saying, there's a lot of ways to do this. I've been growing these really big, fat-stemmed oysters, and you cook them the right way, they taste like scallops. I haven't met many people that don't like scallops. So there's a lot we can do here. We can produce a lot with a little space and a little money and a little time. And if you learn certain techniques, at least certain mushrooms are really easy to self-propagate, like oyster mushrooms, you pretty much grow them forever with waste product around your home. So we'll be talking about all of that more with Kevin in just a minute. Before we do, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day. And sponsor of the day number one today is K9 Academy, K9Academy.us. But if you could, please do me a favor and go buy thesurvivalpodcast.com if you want to know more about K9 Academy and use the link or the banner there. Because I do have an affiliate agreement with Joel, and I get credit for only the people that use the link. But one way or another, you want to check this site out, caninacademy.us, where you can learn to train yourself to train your dog. It all starts with core obedience. That's the course I recommend everybody take. But if you're not sure, like, you're like, do I want to do this? Hey, he's got a problem-solving library. It's like a free mini course. You can see exactly what it's like to learn from Joel online. Go by and take that free course and see if this is right for you and your doggos. Next up today, John Pugliano, who has been part of the team here one way or another at the Survival Podcast since 2010. That's when I first met John in Salt Lake City. He's an amazing guy. He works really hard, and he does a great job as an investment manager. And he takes all his knowledge from all his years of doing his work, and he puts them into about one a week, a podcast called the Wealth Steading Podcast, where you can learn to grow your wealth like you grow a garden. Check it out at wealthsteading.com. And while you're there, click on buy and sell alerts and go there and fill out this little form right here. You fill this out and you will get his email, which will tell you exactly what he's doing with his money and his clients' money. It's really a great little great resource. And again, it's absolutely free. You just put your email and how you heard about him and fill out this little form to make sure you're not a robot, because, you know, he did write the robots are coming, and you'll get those alerts. I read them weekly as they come in. With that, I want to welcome our special guest, Kevin Fitzgerald, to the Survival Podcast. Kevin, welcome, man.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Hey, I'm really good. I'm glad you're on. I've been kind of on like a mushroom series lately. I've done a couple shows of my own. I've brought people in that, you know, run larger companies and sell spawn and stuff like that. Brought a couple in that does, you know, purely a medicinal product out of mushrooms. And now we got somebody that's going to talk about like kind of a mix, like commercial, medicinal, small scale, self-production. So I think that's great. How did you, Kevin, though, get into mushrooms in the first place?
Well, you were kind of a big part of that, to be honest with you. I, much like you, I was in the communications business, doing a lot of contracting on the road a lot, and it wasn't too good for my health, eating a lot of crap food when you're on the road and working long hours and, you know, the whole nine in the cabling industry. And moved into this house. I wanted to do something a little more interesting than, you know, back. Oh, this was 12 years ago, 10 years ago, give or take. Anyway, you know, there's a lot of these mushrooms I had never even tried. And foraging here in Phoenix isn't much of a thing. You know, we do have a monsoon season here, but it's been a non-soon this year. So, you know, go up north and mushroom hunt a couple times a year, really getting into it. But wanted to try all these different things culinarily, you know. And I was listening to you a lot and how you turn your home into a homestead. And I'm like, I can't really afford land, but I've got a pretty big house. My kids moved out. So I got a couple extra rooms and you can see this room here is full of these bags and kind of took over the spare room and built a shed out back and started learning about humidification and air conditioning and all that fun stuff over the years and really, really expanded. We do a little bit of everything. A lot of that's your inspiration too. You know, add another product instead of, you know, sell more to your existing customers instead of looking for new customers kind of thing. And, it's been an interesting journey. I'm full time now, have been for probably close to 7-8 years doing this. We have about 600 bags staged in this room at any given time, give or take. The walk-in closet back there behind me is kind of my my clean room. Laminar flow hood and an impulse sealer. And got a pretty good system. Employ both my my wife works part-time with us. She actually does a lot. And my son-in-law and my daughter also work with me.
That's very cool, man. You said in your in the notes when you applied to be on the air that you actually started out with microgreens.
Yeah, that's why we kind of ended up with the name Sun Valley Harvest. I wasn't sure what I was going to do. Okay. I was doing plant starts, cactuses. I still do all that stuff because that's what I enjoy to do, you know. I grew a lot of microgreens back then. Yeah, microgreens is kind of a flooded market, and I was the only guy. Well, there was one other guy in Arizona doing mushrooms at the time when I started. I'm like, well, I got kind of got first mover advantage, you know, for sure, and ended up at the farmers markets and doing a lot of customer training. It's gotten quite a bit easier to sell mushrooms now. It's kind of the latest thing.
Yeah, there
but
is.
I remember when I first grew lion's mane, nobody would buy it.
Yeah. I would say there is an advantage to going first, but it's not probably as big of an advantage as a lot of people think because they weren't there when there was no market and you had to build one. So the real advantage is as you build the market, you own it, and it's harder to take it away from an incumbent than it is to gain a customer that doesn't already have a supplier. But you also have to create a market that's not there. And I've actually heard that comment on lion's mane from a lot of people. Like, this is a super hot mushroom right now, both culinarily and medicinally. But go back a few years and it really wasn't. People looked at it as kind of weird looking. It looked like, you know, something that grows on a, you know, like a dying tree or something. It's kind of odd. It doesn't look like what we think is a mushroom. And if you get somebody to try it, especially like there's dozens of ways to prepare it. Almost everybody has a way you can prepare that mushroom they'll like. But until you know that, it kind of looks like some kind of weird alien thing.
Oh, you know, we had to actually start a little catering business and set up at the farmer's market, cook mushrooms, and give them away in order to really start building a clientele. And we would do, my wife actually would make like Philly steak and cheese kind of deals. And those were super popular. It's a lot of work to cook food.
We've
gone away from that now after we built up the clientele, but it was really nice. It was kind of fun.
The mythical 80s drug dealer model, where the first one's free. I grew up in school being told everybody around every corner is going to be offering me free drugs. Never happened, but the concept was sound. You give the first one out for free, get them hooked, and then you have a client you can sell to.
So, I like that analogy.
I think it works, right? Like, it's a product marketing technique that's worked for a long time. I remember back in the 80s, right, walking through the mall, and they'd been around a while, but in larger markets, like I was in Jacksonville, Florida, no one had ever heard of Chick-fil-A. It was just not a thing, right? And then a lady would be out there with a platter full of little pieces of chicken and toothpicks in them, and they'd be handing them out, and you eat one of that, and you're like, do they put crack in the chicken? Like, why is this so good? And next thing you know, everybody's a customer of Chick-fil-A. And so I think, like, getting people to try something, especially something outside of their wheelhouse, is a huge part of onboarding them. You know, we did the same thing with Bitcoin. We gave away billions of dollars worth of Bitcoin back in, like, 2012, you know, just trying to get people on board. But that is what it takes sometimes.
Try it before we buy it.
Yeah. So let's start off with, like, one of the things I really like about growing mushrooms here, and I do a lot of oysters because they're, like, the perfect beginner's mushroom. They're very easy to do. And I cultivate an awful lot of my spawn on coffee grounds, and then I'm even growing out on, like, a mix of coffee grounds and biochar and wood pellets. And that's probably not the best substrate, though, for a lot of other things. But the idea that you could take what would otherwise be garbage, get a highly, very expensive product out of it, and eventually you still have a compost, that's actually pretty cool. What do you recommend people look around for and use those substrates?
Hardwood pellets is the best. I mean, Costco, Ace, they all have it. I would, beginners always try to steer towards straw and Tractor Supply. What's the other big one? You know, everybody's got some kind of company like that around.
Especially
rural Atwoods. I'm trying to think of the other one. It's escaping my mind. Anyway, they sell pre-chopped straw. So it's about 3 to 4 inch pieces. And mushrooms, especially oysters, readily go crazy on that. And they eat through it very fast. You know, the hollow part of the stem, they burn through that lignin really quick, leap over to the next piece. And, you know, it's pretty simple. I liked your sous vide idea the other day. That's genius right there. We do something similar on a larger scale using steam. And then we also do sterilization, obviously. But if you've got a pressure cooker, you can make your own spawn in jars. Let me grab one. Make these little lids with a filter and an injection port.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you can sterilize a couple jars at a time of spawn on grain in your pressure cooker and inoculate a big bag of straw. Or you can buy one of these bags from me at the farmer's market or order one online and expand that out to a large amount of straw. Wood chips work pretty well.
There's a huge value in that I don't think many people see. I mean, it's fine, and I've done quite a bit of it where, like, you go to a place like North Spore or Mushroom Mount or whatever, and you buy sawdust spawn that's fully inoculated, and you band up the bag and cut some holes in it and throw it in a Martha tent, and you get mushrooms. And it's foolproof. It's a great start. But when you look at, you know, the cost of that bag being between $25 and $30 between who you buy it from, and then some places do or don't have shipping that adds to it, you could take that bag or a bag of grain spawn and do what you just said, and you can make easily 20 bags out of it. Way more cost.
You can get, with straw, you can buy that tubing.
Yeah.
You know, 8-inch tubing or 12-inch tubing, and you can make a huge, you know, and you see people do it in buckets. You know what I mean?
Wait, let's
and
go you back can, to this tubing. What are you talking about, this tubing? This is something I haven't seen.
The tubing is, picture this bag.
Okay.
You know, but in a tube, and you can buy that tubing on you know, wherever. I've got some of it out there. We do classes, and we'll take a 55-gallon drum, put a burner under it, put a couple blocks under it so you have room for the burner to be under the 55-gallon drum. Okay. Heat up the water, fill up mesh bags full of that straw.
Okay.
Throw it in that boiling water, submerge it with the brick, pull it out, and then throw it on a table, cover it with something, let most of the water drain out, and then I'll just bring in a couple bags of the you know, mushroom stuff, mix all that in together, and then shove it in a big tube. It's just a tube of polyurethane, you know, it's for it's kind of the stuff that lines the air conditioning. It's just a tube of
and
then
like
seal it with zip ties. The net is what you use to get it in the boiling water so the heat kills all the microbes, competing microbes. Pull that out.
I was a little confused. I was thinking you were talking
there
about
you go.
Like French poly drain material or something. It's like a poly mesh.
That's what you're going to actually grow the mushrooms in.
And it's cheap. Okay, that makes sense. I get it now. It just I've never seen that before, but apparently it is a thing in the mushroom space.
That's what we do for our classes, and everybody takes home a, you know, a big old piece of, you know, a grow kit and watch it grows out at home. You got it. When you do the tubing, you need to add air. I mean, all these bags here have a way for the mushrooms to get some air. I do is I take a bunch of broadheads from for my bows, and I put them all on a board, and then everybody takes their tube and stabs the roll of tubing, and then there you go. That's it. They get some air in there, and they don't really contaminate that much on straw.
They're all the same size, and they're all spaced the same because you basically made a jig.
Exactly.
That's cool. I have seen that before now. I just didn't know that's what it was. I've seen YouTube videos with the giant tubes hanging, especially oysters. Like, it seems like a lot of people do oysters on those. That's really cool. I guess if you want to, like, go really cheap on the straw and you're getting bales and you need to cut your straw up some.
Yeah, you know, and, you know, what we used to do is take a weed eater and a 55-gallon drum, dump all the straw in there, and, I'd find that straw in my pillow at night. I don't know how it gets into everything. I hated working with straw.
I know how to do that. You need a garbage can, like a tough can, and you need, because I thought about it, didn't work for biochar, but it would totally work for what you're saying. And then you take the shaft, you know, you can take the handle off the weeder, you put the shaft through a hole in the top of the garbage can, put the lid on it, and then you can go ape shit on it. You cut like a little groove in it so you can get into the center. And then that way, almost none of the straw gets out. Cool. We came up with a new technique. Now, so how's somebody out there to try to do it for us and tell us if it worked or not? And if you end up.
That's actually what I did. Well, that's how I started doing this.
Yeah.
It's pretty hard to find hardwood pellets in Arizona. We don't have cold winters here in Phoenix. You know what I mean? So they're. Barbecue's become huge now too, so you can go into any Walmart or Costco and buy hardwood pellets now, but I don't remember pellet stoves being a thing back then, you know what I mean? Now pellet stoves, Traeger and everything, they're pretty readily available.
But like when you go to like a grocery store or whatever and you buy those pellets, you're paying 3x what fuel pellets cost. Right?
Yeah.
They're expensive.
Oh, well. Order them by the tonnage, obviously.
Yeah, you're a different world, but what I'm saying is if you can find somebody selling the hardwood fuel pellets, they're about seven-ish to $8 a bag. And, like, cheap cooking ones, which probably are the same thing, are, like, 14 to 25 a bag. So that's a big difference. I will say, like, if you're stuck because you're in a place like Kevin is and you're not going to buy them by the pallet and you have to use a barbecue product, Costco has a mixed hardwood pellet that is about $12 a bag. And I know that because I don't use them for mushrooms. I use them for my pellet smoker because they're half of a Traeger or a Pit Boss or something like that. But
those do work. Yep. We've grown on those.
Yep.
We had a shortage in our delivery coming, and I just went to – I tried to get them to give me a pallet price at Costco. They wouldn't do it.
No. Oh, they'll give you a pallet price. They'll be like, so there's 80 on a pallet, and here's your price. That's how they're like, we're already giving you a great price. So, but let's talk about like the sterile technique stuff too. Like, I look at what people that are doing this very professionally, you know, as professionally as you, or even like people that are making pure cultures from a spore print or something, and their laboratory level of QA, right, is through the roof. And that's good. I'm not knocking it. But if you take a person who, you know, has an apartment or a small home and they just want to grow 5 pounds of mushrooms a week or 2.5 pounds of mushrooms a week, something like that, they're not going to do all that. And there are low-tech methods, right, that people can use to make sure that they have reasonable success.
Very much so. And you can be very technically sterile without a flow hood. You can buy 100-pack of syringes on Amazon for like $20. You know, and the needles, you know, you get the big fat needles. You can buy them at the feed store. Heck, they have them at Tractor Supply. Make a bunch of those lids I showed you, you know, and you can sterilize. You can do all your transfers via liquid and in a sterile jar. So you can keep a lot of sterility without, and, you know, and then you can inject your bags of grain. Once you have grain is used because it's so easy to break up, and each one of those little grains becomes a spot where the mushrooms grow. I mean, I can grab a bag here and you can see where it's growing out. Every little bit of grain in there is expanding out. Oh, here's one. You can see, I don't know how well you can see on the camera. You can see all the little grains in there. These are ones from yesterday that haven't even started growing out yet. Within 24 to 48 hours, you'll start to see little white dots where each little piece of grain is on this hardwood. It grows out really quick.
That's something I probably need to do when I'm buying spawn is, just since I do make more out of it, stop buying sawdust spawn and start buying grain spawn.
Well, it's probably pretty hot where you're at, but you can order liquid cultures.
Okay.
So they'll grow them out on sugar water, and you inject them into the, you know, you've got your little injection port, spray it with a little alcohol, and then you can grow out more sugar water, sterile sugar water, and then inject it into your bags of grain, or you can just do some more jars with, you know, I like the jars that, you know, the quart and a half that don't have the, you know, lip that it gets stuck in there. So you can break it up real easy and shake it out. There you go. I don't see that jar versus, the straight walled ones.
Yeah.
Here's one. The straight walled ones.
Oh, those are even better if you find them. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah,
these are better than the smallmouth jars because they have a shoulder, but it's really, really modest.
It's not too bad.
I grew it in a smallmouth jar once, never again, because I actually ended up with it because of that steep shoulder. It was actually like it left a gap and it started pinning inside the jar. Like it, not what you're going. This is this is from Blue Oyster stems. That's all that is Blue Oyster stem. I need to get this cultivated out or something because it's trying to pin through the.
They'll eat their way out of that filter patch.
There's a whole lump now pushing up on the first aid tape. But I mean, that's what I've been doing mostly is just these jars like this. That's a golden oyster. And the thing I like about the oysters is, and I guess I saw some guy do this on YouTube. I'm like, well, shit, that's awesome. Is you just basically cut open the stem and take the tissue from inside the stem and you can cultivate your next batch. And I don't know that there's any other mushrooms that you can do that or do that and get the level of success. I've had like one jar go bad and I've done it probably 2 or 3 dozen times now. So it's been very consistent. And the one that went bad, I know exactly why it went bad because I was lazy as shit that day. You don't have to go too far with it. I mean, basically, I just cut with a sterile scalpel blade into the center of the stem and take it from inside so that you don't have whatever contaminants might be on the outside. Are there any other mushrooms that you can do that with readily?
Actually, all mushrooms.
Really?
Grow from, well, some require symbiosis where there's a bacteria associated with them, but for the most part, you can isolate fungi on agar very well. Now, whether or not it's going to eat wood chips or straw or coffee grounds, that gets a little more complicated. But when you get into agar culture, just that sugar broth we're talking about, which is only like, I think it's 10 parts per million. It's really just a little bit of sugar. Okay. You know, a little honey, a little caro syrup, whatever. And they'll grow readily in that. You know, and then once you kind of get a little low-tech method down where you're growing some mushrooms, you can either stop there or you can get kind of crazy. People get into still air boxes, small flow hoods, you know, because it's important. Every mushroom you see in here is a clone. Yeah. Like a banana tree, right?
Yeah.
You're using the stem butt as the corm on a banana tree or whatnot.
Yeah.
Or apples. So if you take a spore from a mushroom, you may not get something that's going to produce well. I mean, if you take spores from a blue oyster, 90% of the time you end up with a white oyster from spore that may or may not produce a big, beautiful cluster, may or may not like what you feed it. It may want a more natural environment because it's kind of reverting back to its more natural state. Whereas they've isolated this one blue mushroom.
There's two
strains that are readily grown.
It's like plants on steroids. It's like plants on steroids. Cause when I was reading one of Paul Stamets' books, and when I was looking at when they spore out, how much spore one mushroom produces, it dwarfs anything else other than like a maybe bacteria or something. Like, it is unbelievable in the velocity they come out at. So all those spores are like a seed. They're not, but they're like a seed, an analogy there. And just like if I take the seeds from a pepper plant, depending on what it cross-pollinated with, that will tell me what my daughter generation will be there. Where with the mushroom, there's a gazillion spores, and each one has its own differentiation in some level of genetics. But when I take that tissue culture, it's the same as taking that pepper I have, taking a cutting off of it, putting it in an ebb and flow bed until it roots, and then planting it. I'm going to get it's the same plant, a clone.
Exactly.
It's the same plant, but it's self-sufficient.
Yep. And you run into things like genetic bottlenecks doing that. You know, like if you clone that pepper out 10 million times, it might just start to wither and die.
Yeah.
You know, but for the most part, like this 3015 strain, there's almost every blue oyster mushroom in the United States comes from this one company that makes massive amounts of spawn. And they're the same company that makes Portobello. Amicil is the name of the company, and they won't even deal with small guys like us anymore. But anyway, they grow. If you can imagine the amount of mushrooms produced that are all the exact same genetic clone, it's insane. Every grocery store across the entire United States, probably all of North America, came from one little bit of tissue culture. You know, Portobello, White Button, and Cremini are actually all the same genetic mushroom. They're the same Agaricus bisporus. So they're not even cousins. They're the same mushroom, just grown in different environments. So just think of all those millions of pounds of mushrooms all over the United States came from one little tissue culture in California or Pennsylvania. Interesting to think about that. Probably one of the largest organisms on the world, if you think about it, by mass. It's hard to judge how much a mycelium is part of an organism or not, though. I mean, it's very fine filamentous threads that eat through the bags.
It's weird, too, as you look, like, even within, like, a main family, like oyster, like, even the mycelium's different, right? Like, what I was saying, you know, this is that blue, right? And this is the golden, and it's almost fully myceliated. And it just has this finer, light,
wispy,
yeah, yeah.
Wait till you smell it. It smells totally different, too.
Yeah, it smells amazing.
Yeah, golden oysters have a really interesting smell. I mean, look at the mycelium of lion's mane. Is that wispy?
Yeah.
But look, it's already trying to fruit on top.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah. Very aggressive, but doesn't, it's not firm. Like the oysters. The oysters, they'll grow really firm in the bag. Some of the goldens are like that, too. There's a couple different strains of goldens out there that I think are a little bit genetically different. It's interesting that now with genetic testing, mushrooms are actually pretty easy to genetically test. So we're finding out that all these we thought was the same mushroom is totally genetically different from what we thought right now. Yeah. It's really interesting, like chanterelles. We have our own native chanterelle to Arizona, they think, now, because it's genetically different from the ones that grow back east.
Yeah.
And different from the ones in California. On and on and on.
It makes sense that even if you started, like, let's say I cloned a mushroom that was indigenous to Pennsylvania, and I found a place in Arizona they actually would grow, because northern Arizona is not what people think, I think, a lot of people. Like, I've been up in, like, the Black Oak Canyon and all. It's you know, you go from Sedona, that's like this red-painted desert, to, like, oh, my God, it's giant trees and it's gorgeous. So you find a place where they can survive, but that mushroom then starts to self-propagate in a totally different biome. And we just acknowledge that when you use spores, you're going to end up with differentiation. Well, that's how mushrooms do it in nature, more so than just straight, like, self-cloning, like mycelial mat. So you're going to end up, even if it looks very similar, something genetically different, I would think.
Oh, and even more interesting is, so we were talking about the spores, right? So you have one little microscopic spore, and that one little microscopic spore can grow out and become all these bags, but they'll never produce a mushroom. The mushroom doesn't want to produce a mushroom until it's trying to express its genetics. So until it mates, much like our chromosome, a male and a female, kind of, you can think of it that way. Until it mates with another fungus, exchanges new genetic information, it won't produce a fruit. So they can live, different mushrooms can live in the soil. We have, in Arizona, we have the largest ponderosa forest in the northern hemisphere. Ponderosa, and there's a lot of mushrooms associated with ponderosa. Most plants in the world have some kind of mycorrhizal fungus that they need to grow. I mean, tomatoes don't. You can grow those in just, you know, water. But, you know, lettuces, most of the plants that we eat in the grocery store, but almost every other plant in the world needs some kind of biodiversity, symbiotic relationships, like our microbiome. You know, it's this whole complicated web that, once you get down the rabbit hole, mushrooms are so fascinating. You can go down any number of rabbit holes and it's crazy. Take, for instance, they started to grow lodgepole pines in South America.
Yeah.
South America doesn't have the mycorrhizal mushrooms in the soil that associate with them. So they, you know, grow them all in sterile soil, blah, 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 put them on big container ships, drive them down there. Okay, we plant them in the ground. Look, they're doing weight. We, you know, never mind they cut down a beautiful rainforest to do this.
Yeah.
Hundreds and thousands of acres of lodgepole pine. They get up to about 10 feet, 15 feet, and then they start growing. And then they just never thrive. They just can't survive. So now they have boletes in South America. They figured it out eventually and cut down even more rainforest. Good for them, right? But anyway, so now there's boletes in South America, which are not native to South America. The yellow oyster is naturalized all over the United States now. And it's not native to the United States at all. I forget where it's from, but it's not native to the United States.
It's somewhere in Asia.
It's a warm weather. Yeah, somewhere in Asia. A warm weather one. Same with pinks. I've never seen pinks growing in the wild, but I've seen lots of pictures and a lot of yellows. Yellow's very aggressive, you know, takes off. And it does hold true to its genetic diversity. But it'll breed with native fungi, too.
That's
right.
True. Yeah.
So at some point it might want to express a blue or a white or a brown or whatever genetic.
We don't even know yet, right?
Like, we have no idea. And all this happens under our feet and in logs, and, you know, you can't see it or know much about it. It's really interesting.
If you go back, say, 500 years, the majority of dog breeds didn't exist yet. It's a 500-year human project breeding all these different dog breeds out. If you go back 150 years, a lot of the breeds that we think of didn't look like they do today. Like a border collie did not look 150 years ago like it looks today. That's one true species. And I think one of the places people get hung up on mushrooms is they take saying mushrooms like saying dogs, right? Like, so if you're a dog expert, I would expect you know what a poodle is. But if you say you're a botanist, so you study plants, I don't expect that you know every plant on the planet, because there's a gazillion of them. and there's new ones, you know, being created through crossbreeding. And we talk about mushrooms like it's just a section in the grocery store or something, and it's the third kingdom.
And if you expand that to fungi, you know, in general,
yeah,
just think of how massive that is.
We
wouldn't have beer or cheese or bread or
no
without fungi.
No,
and so a lot of funguses never produce a mushroom.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Tons of them. And then a lot of them, I found out they do, but you might not even see it. It's incredibly tiny, and it's not something that we would look at and call a mushroom, but based on what we call a mushroom, that's what it is. My point is just it's so huge, and I had forgotten to remember what I just learned that you just reminded me of, and that is that there is a breeding with spores. I just learned that in one of Paul Stamets' books as I've been learning more about this. That's kind of actually earth-shattering because I don't think most people would think that that's the case. You can have this huge mycelium mat, but if it's from a single spore, it will never fruit.
Some frogs, hermaphrodites, and some, yeah, you know, they've had whatever in a zoo and there was never a male around and, oh, it had a baby. I mean, there are cases in nature where nature finds a way, like in Jurassic Park, right?
Yeah.
But generally speaking, that is a truism.
Yeah. Yeah.
And here I'm growing mostly 3015s, which is the specific strain. I don't know if that means that there was 3,115 iterations of breeding to get to this. But then you get into monokaryotes and dikaryotes, and it gets pretty complicated to do the breeding. Cordyceps is something I play with breeding on. And I've played with breeding on trying to cross native mushrooms into my grows, grow them out, you know, never get that commercial, you know, big, beautiful cluster that my customers want to see. But it's fun. It's fun. And I really enjoy it because I get the grow thing. I get the science thing. I get the mad scientist, get my flow hood, put the mask on, kind of gloves and all that fun stuff. I got to get me a nice lab coat. Feel important.
Pocket protector. Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
I should start doing YouTube videos looking like a scientist instead of a.
It would probably work.
There's a guy here locally that does that.
Yeah.
If you're interested in breeding back to liquid cultures, Mossy Creek Mushrooms does a lot of this breeding on liquid culture.
Okay.
And then you can order different strains from him, and you can grow oysters that he has crossbred, grown out in his grow room, worked with, and produce well at home, but are totally different than anything you'll see, like the common blue or white or you know, the Phoenix oysters and so on and so forth.
So you were talking to me on Facebook about, you know, building a basic Martha tent for as little cost as possible. Can you kind of talk to the audience about, you know, what that is?
I love those.
And I think for a person that wants to produce reliably across time in a small space, it is probably the best thing to do. If you live in a climate where you can grow, you know, wine caps in your garden or whatever, effing do that. But there's a ton of people that can't because of, like, where I live, like, it's almost as dry as it is where you are, right? And it's very hot and very dry is the bigger problem. And we could get some mushroom growth outside, but not any kind of reliability approaching anything in, like, half the year even. So I think it's the best way to go. How do you do that? And what are you looking for when you put something like that together?
Well, I like the open bottom ones versus the sealed ones. You're basically looking for an ultrasonic humidifier and a tent to hold the humidity in. I bought my first grow was in a walk-in closet. I bought a Harbor Freight, you know, tent. It was open on the bottom, had two zippers up the sides and three shelves about 3 feet wide, 2.5, 3 feet wide. Right. And it's already got shelves in there for you and everything. Got an ultrasonic humidifier at Goodwill.
Okay.
Found a hose to like one of those foot bath machines that stirs up the water. Jerry-rigged that hose to the top of the ultrasonic humidifier, ran it up to the top of the tent with no kinks in the hose because the kink can fill up with water, blah, blah, blah. Just up and down, drop the humidity right in the top, set that sucker on a timer. It goes off 5 minutes every 15 minutes.
Okay.
Put a pan for like, whatever, for dripping your car, you got a leaky oil leak. They sell this big old pan, fits right under that tent perfectly. And it was the perfect little setup. And that's perfect in the kitchen. And you can fit, you don't want to overload it too much because then you start to run into oxygen issues. But carbon dioxide's heavier than oxygen, so it tends to fall out the bottom of the tent. You're piping in your humidity over the top, which is heavy, pushes the carbon dioxide out the bottom. So you're getting pretty good airflow in there. You could probably do 20 grow kits at any given time. These 5-pound grow kits should produce 2 to 3 pounds of mushrooms,
okay,
give or take, for the well-researched strains like these. On Master's mix, this mix is real heavy in nutrients. So you'll get, if you're using less nutrient-dense substrates, you'll get less mushrooms. But if you're kind of low-tech expanding it out, having fun with it, you know what I mean? How many people started taking up sourdough cooking during COVID? You know what I mean? This is even more fun.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it's more reliable, in my opinion. I've killed, I don't know how many sourdough starters.
So what about, you know, the airflow? Okay, fine. But if that's just all falling out, what about the spores? Like, one of the things I've read is that with growing a lot of mushrooms indoors, you really should be spore filtering. So I have an exhaust fan on my tent and it goes through a filter media, and I actually have it on the intake and the outtake of that. And about once every 2 weeks, I remove that, clean it, and put it back on. But what I've heard is that, like, this can actually be hazardous to your health, just to be breathing in too much spore.
It can. I wouldn't worry about it on a small scale. I really wouldn't. Okay. You're breathing a million spores right now. And you're not, you know, if you took an agar plate in front of the flow hood, a completely clean environment, which you're going to see 30 different things grow on that thing.
Okay.
The colors are quite fascinating. You'll get green mold, black mold, blah, blah, blah. You know, if you're immunocompromised, you might want to have some concerns with that. When you get to a large scale like mine, where you're going to spend more than an hour or two in the grow room, yes, you would want to wear a mask.
Okay.
I wouldn't worry about it too much. If I lived in Pennsylvania where it was very moist all the time, I would want to grow outdoors because you could. And I wouldn't want spores in the house because there's so much moisture that the mushrooms might start eating my furniture.
Yeah.
That would be a concern. But in, you know, Phoenix, most of your Southwest, California, you know, I mean, come on. It's a concern if you're immunocompromised. I wouldn't be too concerned with spores. You know, especially when you first start the hobby, you know, your spore load's not going to be heavy. Pick your oysters before the caps flatten out. Right? You want to pick them when they're at that curved mark, and they're not sporing very heavy yet.
Okay.
When they flatten out, they're going to produce billions of spores very quickly.
Yeah.
So you want to, you know, you want to catch them a little young to try to avoid spore load. Tastes better that way too because it's a firmer mushroom. So, you know, win-win, right? But I wouldn't be too over-concerned with it. You know, if this hobby's going to go years and years on, you know, yes, you're going to want to add some protection for your spores. And, you know, I don't always wear a mask when I go on my grow.
Yeah. And like, you know, I bought a pre-configured tent. Actually, I was given to me by North Spore. And one of the things they have in there is a humidity sensor that kicks that humidifier on and then cuts it off. But you're taking a different approach. You're just saying to maybe go off like 5 minutes every hour or something like that.
Five minutes every, depending on your climate. This time of year, you're gonna want that sucker to kick on. I like to get the 5 minute timers. There's the 5 and the 15 minute increments, and then I do like 5 minutes every 15. So five on, 15 off, 5 on, 15 off. You know, and you could dial it in. That sensor for humidity is going to die within 6 months. They all do. So then you're just going to want to run out to your shed, grab a timer, plug it in, and go.
Okay.
You know,
if your humidity sensor
lasts a year, I would be surprised. You got lucky.
Now, what's interesting though is you're like, that's like 4 cycles an hour, and having sat in the office and watched it go, I would say that that's about what it's doing with a sensor is about the same. So if you set it to do 5 every 15 minutes, it would probably like 5 on, 15 off. It probably would end up in about the same state. That's interesting. Now, does it run for 5 minutes? I don't know.
Just keep an eye on it. You want to see some condensation on the tent. If you're seeing condensation on the tent that's pretty consistent, then you know your humidity is up around that 90 percentile range.
Yeah.
80 to 90% is where you're seeing condensation. So you kind of learn real quick how to dial it in. And then, you know, some mushrooms you want a little drier. Some mushrooms you want to do a little wetter. You know, everybody starts with oysters, and then you want to try growing some lion's mane. You might want your lion's mane to be a little on the drier side because it's pretty sensitive to too much humidity because of its spongy texture. It'll soak up too much and kind of ruin the effect of the mushroom growing. Bruises easy once it gets too wet, so on and so forth. But once you start getting into different mushrooms, and you can just kind of put them all in the same tent and go for it. It's not a big deal. We grow many different mushrooms in our grow room. Me being so small scale, I kind of got to cram everything I into a small space.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm not going to have a tent for oysters and a tent for lion's mane and a tent for, and I don't think most small people are going to do that either. Now, you may kind of focus on something this week and then next week on something else, and then you have a little more latitude to change things around. But that's actually a good lead into my next question anyway. Types of mushrooms you grow. Now, we've mentioned oysters, and I think that the adding of itself is, well, which oysters? Like, I think I've grown
that's
like...
That's a big rabbit hole in and of itself, right? I mean, there's a lot of
different species of oysters.
There's at least 4 or 5 distinct groups of oysters that are totally unique.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the black pearl, the blues, the browns, the yellows, the pinks. That's, what, 6?
Yeah. And then you've got your phoenix or
Italian. Oh, your kings.
Right.
Yeah, well, that's the brown oyster would be your phoenix, your Italians. The subspecies is called pulmonarius, and they have a wavy cap margin, so they named it after lung tissue or something. I don't know where that name came from. But pulmonarius, good warm weather strain. I just try to point people towards mushrooms that grow readily at temperatures that you are comfortable in.
Exactly.
So, you know what I mean? You're 70 to 80 degrees, and all the oysters except for kings fall into that range. I would kind of wait till winter for black pearls, but I probably would avoid even trying to grow kings in a home. They like it below 70 degrees, and then your wife gets pretty mad at you.
Yeah, I haven't had much luck with kings. Now, fortunately, I'm getting those weird oysters, but and I'm more concerned with how I'm doing that so I can keep doing it on purpose. Because you saw the blue oysters I'm growing, these huge, they grow like a king.
I'm wondering if that might be, since you're ordering this time of year and it sits in the mail truck, the genetics might get a little damaged in this heat.
Maybe.
So you may not be able to repeat it in the winter when the weather's nice. So we'll kind of a wait and see thing, because it sounds like you've kind of gone over everything you need to do to get it right. Yeah. You know, to get them to fruit a more defined cluster.
And I mean, like my pinks and my goldens are normal.
Pinks kind of don't get leggy because they don't really have individual stems. So it's hard to use pinks as an indicator for your CO2 levels, but yellows, they get leggy quick.
Yeah, my goldens don't, my Italians don't. They all look normal. It's just the blues that do that. And it's all blues because I've grown spawn out like that from North Spore. I've grown spawn out like that from Mushroom Mountain. And I've grown
two different lines.
Yeah. One I thought maybe it was something about handling because it was it started out as one of those box kits, and those things could be, who the hell knows where they go before they end up where they're supposed to. But no, all my blues come out that way. It's weird. And I don't know, maybe I've got some sort of, fungal cross contamination for my fingers. I don't know. But I wanted to actually get in, what are other mushrooms that people should consider growing? Like, we always start with oysters because they're easy, they're fast, and if you screw it up, then you're not ready to do something else, I guess is the way to look at that. Lion's Mane, we've talked about. That's kind of like the ultimate gourmet that's also still pretty damn easy. But are there other mushrooms that people in this type of like small scale cultivation should be considering?
You can do shiitake. Yields are a little low on shiitake, and they're pretty cheap in the grocery store, so I don't usually point people in that direction, but it's an option.
Okay.
Very long incubation period, so there's some drawbacks to shiitakes, but we do grow shiitakes. Let's see here. We got chestnuts. Chestnuts fruit pretty well. probably a little easier to grow in the winter. Here's a chestnut. Look at different. Look at the mycelium on this chestnut. See that brown?
Yeah.
Totally different mycelium.
Yeah.
That's a chestnut mushroom. So that's in the Phyllota family. There's a couple mushrooms in the Phyllota family. I think enokis are in the Phyllota family. Phyllota adiposa. Anyway, you can do enokis. Look totally different when you grow them in a tent setup. You see enokis like in the grocery store that have the real long little, almost no cap. Those are just grown in a very low oxygen environment. They put a sleeve around it so that they grow up trying to get to the oxygen. That's how they get that long, and they're kind of white because they keep them in the dark. Enokis in the wild are a beautiful golden color with a slimy cap. Some people don't like that slimy cap, but you fry that sucker crispy and that slime goes away.
Yeah.
And totally different culinary profile, much better flavor when you get into those. You can do, so I would do chestnut before enokis. Enokis are a little more difficult. But they do pretty well. Again, kind of a winter mushroom, like it a little bit colder. Like I don't really run my AC in the winter at home, so it gets down pretty cold at night. That's when I'm, would be experimenting with stuff like that. You know, Phoenix, it doesn't ever really get frozen in the house, so it's not.
Yeah.
But it does get cold, and we just put a sweater on. You know, why waste electricity? Enokis, so there's the chestnut. Pilpinas are very, that's your next. That would be the go-to next.
Yeah.
You can top fruit or side fruit pilpinas. Pork-like in flavor, kind of the white meat of the mushroom world. Mild, not fungusy. Nice crunchy stem, so you can kind of get that crunchy bit.
The stems are awesome on those. I actually, the last batch I did, I took the stems and cut them in about 2-inch lengths, and you about like get almost like a 6-inch stem with one of them. They're really long, and then the thicker ones, they actually are little fibers. You can actually hit them with a peeler, and then I pickled them, and they are freaking fantastic. Just the stems,
I need to get into that.
Really light pickle too. Like the first mushrooms I pickled once I started this whole new stage of my life, I did a classic 1-to-1 vinegar to water, and it was just like you couldn't taste the mushroom character because there was so much vinegar. And I went to a 3-to-1, which is about your minimal brine that'll give you your preservation, 3 water to 1 vinegar. And those were delicious pickled, and Pink's pickled with the vinegar infused with smoked paprika. It was ridiculously good. And Pink's aren't the best eating mushroom.
But they pair well with acidic dishes.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not a big fan of like fried up Pink's.
Yeah.
But boy, they pair well with acidic dishes. In a red sauce?
Yeah.
Your acidic dishes, Pink's are delicious. My wife makes this vegan chili sometimes, and it's only vegan because we use a ton of mushrooms in it. And the pinks in that chili are amazing.
That works good for that too. Yeah.
We've even taken it up to like the local VFW and stuff, and people eat it up. And those people, they're not mushroom people. And you and your hippie vegan dish, we don't even tell them, and they love it.
Yeah. It's amazing what people like when they don't. Yeah, the pia pepino would be like one of the next step mushrooms. I've done chestnuts and those, and they seem a little easier and a little more forgiving. I also just lost a big flush of chestnuts because I didn't. This is something I would say as a new grower. Check your shit every day, because you go from little pins you don't notice to big-ass flush of mushrooms sometimes in one day. And sometimes you made a place for the mushrooms to come out. Like the chestnuts, like put the slit and then cut the top off the bag and waited for the big. And what they did, for some reason, they wanted to pin out the bottom and they blew a hole in the plastic and it pinned out the back and it pressed up against the back of the tent and it turned into like inky slime because it was smashed against there, right? Like if I had seen that and turned that bag around, I would have lost that flush. And that was kind of depressing.
And again, picking them at their peak ripeness when they're not sporing heavily, because chestnuts have a brown spore, and it can be off-putting in a dish to see, you know, the dewiness of it. It looks off-putting too. It does affect the flavor if you let them get a little too far.
Yeah.
Picking chestnuts young is great. Picking pilpinas, you can kind of let go farther, and they are not heavy spores, but they will spore pretty heavy brown when they do get. But they're kind of a slower to spore mushroom. But chestnuts, man, from one day to the next is a whole.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. Like, oh, I'll let that get bigger. Don't. Don't. That goes from prime to over really quick with some of these species. The Pia Pepinos also, what they did is kind of clued me in on maybe I don't have enough light. Because they were like a plant, not a mushroom. They were literally arched to the window, heading to that UV, and the lighting I had in there was just a really bright LED full spectrum in a lamp next to it I had on a timer, and I ended up taking two of my plant lights and just putting them up on top of the tent, and I get much better form, I think, now with that, you know. It's weird.
Too, and the blues, they'll get bluer when it's colder, but they're trying to melanize for the light. You know, they absorb vitamin D from the sun, and they darker colors, trying to get more light. So, you know, the poor lighting actually gives you better blue color. Pinks in bright light tend to turn less pink for some reason. So starving them of a little light, but yet getting your growth pattern is kind of all these little tricks you learn as you grow them that makes it so fun. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Can you maybe talk a little bit about the spawn production too? Like, we talked about doing the gels and all, but let's keep it simple with the media. Like, I have this new method I'm using now where I'm basically stuffing vacuum seal bags with my stuff, and I'm vacuum sealing it, which you don't grow that way, but it just makes the next part easier. I'm throwing them in a big sous vide tub, and I'm sous vide them at 180 degrees. Not everybody has that kind of a setup. I'm using a really nice, like, $1,500 vacuum sealer, and that's certainly not why I have it. It's another thing that it will do, and it's not why I have the sous vide circulator. There's other things that it does. But what is kind of like the minimal tech for taking care of your spawn or your media, I should say? And then also, let's talk a little bit about doing the spawn production with liquid culture. Kind of where do you need to be with that? You kind of break those in half.
The spawn production with liquid culture is pretty easy.
Okay.
You just got to be real careful about your genetics because they kind of get mushroom diabetes over time because you're feeding them such a simple food. They run into genetic bottlenecks. So at each stage of mushroom growth, if you want to optimize for growth of the mushroom, you need to give them new food so they're expressing their genetics to digest different amounts of things. We start with simple sugars on agar, simple sugars in liquid, and then from there you get into, you know, real basic sugars in seeds. I use mostly millets, but any of your harder mushroom, you know, your harder shelled seeds that won't turn into mush when you overcook them, like, you know, rice, you'd end up with a patty instead of individual grains. You know, winter wheats, hard wheats, things like that are all fine. Millet's the cheapest right now. Milo, white sorghum is what I'm using. The sorghum family is really good. Anyway, so you want to, you know, kind of grow them out onto different media and then start feeding them wood, which is lignin, which is their main fuel source.
Okay.
And then you can start to supplement their lignin. You know, you can go, you know, oak, whatever, hardwoods. Conifers produce a pulmonarius, which is the Phoenix oyster, will eat pine. That's the only oyster that will grow on pine because of the pitch in there is antifungal. Anyway, losing my train of thought there. I get crazy on this stuff. So you, you could start feeding them more and more complex or lignans. Simple carbohydrates to lignin is what you're trying to achieve.
Okay.
Straw works great for beginners because it's very easy to hydrate properly. So, you know, you're the test where you take your wood and you squeeze it, get a couple drops. You're trying to get the right water levels. Then you're mixing in some coffee grounds and this and that, and you'll often end up with bacterial contamination just because of water pockets getting over. So keep it pretty simple at first, and then you can try to get all complicated. I'm going to feed up my coffee grounds and this and that. Biochar is, I think, a great idea.
I
always tell people, always compost your stuff. Just don't leave the bag outside. These bags that are like I use are very UV sensitive because they can take that high heat. But for some reason, you put them in the sun for 3 days in Phoenix, they start to fall apart. And, you know,
I think everything falls apart in 3 days in Phoenix in the sun. I think I would fall apart, right? Like that here. Like literally, if you have exposed PVC pipe here in one season, it'll look like somebody hit it with a torch.
And it'll be discolored.
Literally turn it black. Yeah. It starts to go brown, and then it totally looks like somebody took a propane torch and just like kibayashi'd the outside of it or something. But
this size don't last here.
just kind of for people that are listening to maybe understand the progression you're going there, you correct me if I'm wrong, but you kind of have like your liquid or agar culture. That's like your stage one if you're going from raw tissue culture. That is then used to inoculate grain, and grain is then used to inoculate like a sawdust or a straw. That's exactly. The progression there, right?
Yeah, so, and then you can add extra nutrients once you get into better sterilization techniques. 30% wheat bran works great with the wood. Soy hull pellets, peanut shells, amazing. Lots of protein in there and little bits of peanuts and, you know, cottonseed hulls, all these very high nutrient things that you can add to it will really kick up this, how much, you know, how the mushroom can eat and get a huge mushroom off. When we do the 10 or, you know, 12 pound bags, you can get a 3 pound mushroom. Especially like, and these are all readily available stuff that you can find at Tractor Supply or Atwoods or whatever your local feed store / hardware store. Beet pulp works really good. And it's, you know, horse feed. You just don't get the one with the molasses added. You know, molasses, your simple sugars like that just invite contamination.
And I guess the contamination issue for people to get a hold of it is like, just think if you took moist and you kept the moist and a bowl of coffee grounds on your countertop and you had a bowl next to it of sawdust and you kept it both moist, you misted it every day. You didn't do anything except it's pure. You're going to see mold and wild fungus and shit like that growing on those coffee grounds long before you're going to see it on that sawdust, because that nutrient feeds all things. So when we go really high lignin, low nutrient, mushrooms live on that in nature. Like you see mushrooms growing out of a stump, right? There's not a huge amount of sugar in that stump, right? Like it's mostly just wood. So they can adapt to it. So as you move and you give them more nutrient, they're happy about it. But so is everybody else. And that's why your sanitation has to be better. Your sterilization has to be better because you're giving it more food. That's why, like, doing what I'm doing here and growing, this is pure coffee grounds. This is just straight up, you know, once it colonizes a certain, I just add more so I'm not overwhelming it at the beginning. And those are the ones I've had go bad. I've never had an actual bag of, like, prepared grow media go bad on me yet anyway. I'm sure I will sooner or later, but that's probably not the best, but it works. And, you know, the thing about the coffee is when you dump 190 degree water on it, it's pretty sterilized at that point. So I'm just kind of siphoning it off, but I wouldn't try to make a bag of pure coffee inoculant. I don't think that would probably be the best practice.
No. And it's really hard to get the moisture levels right. Coffee just hides water inside of it somehow. Yeah. But, you know, the most people start with cardboard. We did a class one time where we did something called the Milton Tam method. You can Google that one. There's videos out there. And it's basically shredded newspapers that's used for, like, kitty litter.
Yeah.
You know, pellets of shredded. And that stuff's very sterile because once they pelletize it, it heats it up.
Yeah.
You know, and newspaper is pretty, you know, it's just pure lignin. And a lot of people are like, oh, what about all the ink? I would, most ink these days used in the newspaper industry is soy based. So it's just, and that's an actual added nutrient for the mushroom. I may not want to eat those mushrooms every day for the rest of my life because it would accumulate some heavy metals, maybe, but I don't know. So, mm-hmm. but as an experiment and get something going, I think it's a great little experiment. And they got some really good YouTube videos on that. But any of your, you know, kind of, you know, lignin based, you know, low nutrient stuff is really easy to work with.
Yeah.
I love your sous vide idea. You know,
yeah. It
gives you that extra bit of, you know, extra sterility. Not quite sterile. I mean, we use atmospheric sterilization, which is, 210-ish for 24 hours.
Yeah.
Is what we, and a lot of companies do that even with spawn. You know, you're just trying to get that internal temperature of the bag up to that 200-ish degree mark, which is ultra pasteurization, right?
Yeah.
We're all familiar with pasteurization from milk and whatnot.
Yeah, I'm
kill off all the competing microbes.
That's what the sous vide circulator can hold. And for those that don't know what you're talking about, maybe you didn't hear the show where I've talked about this. What I'm doing, I'm filling up the vacuum seal bags, and I can make like 10 bags at one time. And they are sealed, and I throw them at 180 degrees for about 8 hours. And it could be 10. It's just whatever time they go in the morning, and when I go to put the ducks to bed, I shut it off. And then when I'm ready to inoculate them, I cut them open, I drop my spawn in, I mix it up, I reseal them, I cut a hole in it, and I put a filter patch over that hole, and I let them colonize, right? But the reason I started doing that, I wasn't having problems, but I was concerned about the biochar component, because I'm using about 10% biochar, because I have it. And I started thinking about that and what it does. And what it does is it provides apartments, like it's this microscopic little colonization apartment complex. So if anything's in that biochar, one of the things biochar does is it provides a protective environment. I started thinking maybe this isn't the best thing for mushroom media to have a protective environment for competing microorganisms. And like I said, I asked AI basically, like, what is, will 2 hours work? Yeah, probably. I finally said, what is the number at which it's irrelevant? Anything in there is probably dead, and it said 8 hours, and that's how I came to that number. But what I like about it
is 12 hours is what's commonly used in the mushroom industry.
Maybe I'll just say like 4 more hours. I don't care. And then they stay hot, right? That's the other thing. Like when it's done, I don't take them out. I leave them in there. I just unplug the sous vide circulator and just let them sit in there. It's probably going to stay at temperature for another 2 or 3 hours. That's a lot of mass. But the big thing is that bag, until I'm ready to inoculate it, it just sits on a shelf. It's sealed. Nothing can get in. Everything's dead. I'm not going to eat it, so I guess there is a remote chance of a botulism thing going on, but I highly doubt it given the nature of what it is. And then that way, when I need to do something like get this going into maybe a couple, three bags, I have bags ready. I don't have to start like, okay, now I have to make bags and I have to do that before this batch gets too old or whatever. They're just on the shelf ready to go. And that's kind of how I've tried to put some level of factory efficiency into my little site. Cause this is a hobby for me. I guarantee you will not come to my site and see me selling product out of this space. I want it for probably the main reason most people tuning in today want it, to produce mushrooms so that I can eat them. I mean, that's mainly what I'm looking for out of it.
Well, you could, in the future, you can get into some of the more healthy ones or the, reishis for your immune system and adaptogenics and turkey tails and, lion's mane is used for neurological health. A lot of interesting studies on that. Mushrooms in general are super healthy for you. They did this big study I was reading the other day in Japan where they followed up all these, I think it was like 5,000 men in Japan eating mushrooms. I think it was four times a week. I'm kind of drawing a blank. It was an interesting study anyway. their conclusion was like 30% less all-cause mortality. Kind of up there with working out or sleeping good or you know, sauna, taking vitamins, you know, all these little things that you can do to kind of dial in your lifestyle. Mushrooms should and can be a big part of that, you know, your health overall. Actually, statins are produced by oysters. I don't know how they isolated statin from oysters, but I was reading about that one time that was really interesting. It's not the same statin that they synthesize and give you in a pill, but there are studies that show it lowers, you know, it's good cholesterol, whatever stuff with statins. Blood sugar regulation, huge in shiitakes. It really helps with blood sugar spikes. I mean, there's a lot of benefits to growing and eating mushrooms, and the more connected you are to your food, the better it tastes.
Yeah. I completely agree. What are your thoughts on like the just culinary alone, like different flavor profiles, like the mushrooms that you most enjoy eating or your customers most enjoy eating?
I grow mostly oysters and mostly the blues and the whites. And I never get tired of them. I've been doing this for 10 years now. We eat them 2 or 3 times a week. And I mean, all the different ways you can cook them. I love to make like crispy carnitas out of them. Take a big old cluster and just peel them up and make a big pan full of them. Put another cast iron pan on top, put something heavy on top of that, and let them just fry crispy in some tallow or, you know, I never get tired of that. That's as good as any meat you can serve. The powders, I love the powders. I add that to so many different little dishes just to kick them up a notch, get some of that umami going on, mix some shiitake, some oysters, some lion's mane peels, whatever. Grind them up after they dry, you know, whatever didn't get eaten this week goes into the drying rack and or gets sold. And we make all kind of little powders out of it. And I use that all the time. And it's amazing. Then I'll smoke them and make a smoke powder. So I'm too lazy. I'm going to cook something on a cast iron. I'll put some of that smoked mushroom powder on there, get that extra umami and some of that grill flavor going on too. I mean, mushrooms are just so versatile. They should be in everybody's diet, in my opinion. And like you said, they're relatively easy to grow. And I think there's a lot of fun to be had with it. I mean, those, these little kind of scientific like experiments, you know, are just fascinating. And watching them grow is like, I mean, they just grow so fast.
The speed is what's crazy. You go look and you've got like little bitty pins that are, you know, an inch. And then you go in the next day, there's a whole freaking cluster.
And then it's
crazy how fast they are. Once they decide to go, they go. And then I guess the other thing I keep kind of harping on is pay attention because they also go over really quick too on you. And some are like lion's mane can hang out for quite a while compared to
like an
oyster. An oyster, like you said, once that fan really like starts to upturn and spore out, it's the next day it looks like it's starting to dehydrate even in the damn tent.
It stops feeding itself. It puts all of its energy into producing the spore or the seed, you know. And I think seed is actually a very good analogy for spores. You know, and there are plants that produce spores too, you know, ferns. You know, it's a genetic thing that's been recreated in nature in several ways.
Let's hit a few questions here from the audience quick. Now, I didn't start. Anyway, the chicken of the woods thing, I don't think anybody's doing those indoors or anything. I miss that mushroom, and I miss, honestly, the days I thought of it as second tier. And the reason I thought of it was second tier is in Pennsylvania, they're literally everywhere, and you can see them from 50 yards away. So it's not even just that there's more of them. You can see them. They're a beautiful mushroom, but I don't know that anybody cultivates that mushroom.
I've seen a few people get a few fruitings off of them, but there's something that we don't understand about them. They just don't do too well indoors. I had one little one grow once when I was playing around with cultures on them, and it wasn't very much, but it sure was cool to see. And it didn't get a good orange color either, so I was a little hesitant at first. And they're pretty slow growing from my experience in culture. But unfortunately, we can't figure that one out very well.
You know, we have mushrooms that are
hen of the woods. We grow hen of the woods.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's tricky, but it's definitely done. Yeah. It's also
it's much
more in demand. Man, that is we used to sell that mushroom, Mataki Head of the Woods, we used to sell that for $10 a pound with a scale across a bar. Like, and where I grew up in Pennsylvania, there's a bar, every corner has a bar in town, right? So we would find a big haul of them and like realize like we can't process all these in a day, you know? And we would go bar to bar to bar with a scale and set it on, and we $10 a pound in the 1980s. Right? Have you been around? Well, $10 in the 1980s bought you a lot more than it does today. So I mean, there's a real reason that people are trying to cultivate that regularly, because it commands a high price. It's amazing to me. That's my favorite mushroom, honestly, to eat is Mataki.
They're not too bad to grow if you want to grow them and never try to fruit them in the fruiting chamber. Just let them grow in the bag.
Okay.
And they won't be real pretty, but the flavor is amazing.
Okay.
They kind of get this blobby look to them, and they don't flower out with the, you know, hen of the woods. Maitake is the name of it. Mi, I think, means dancing. Dancing mushroom is what's called in Japan. Anyway, you'll get this brain-like formation, but it is one of the best tasting ways to eat maitake that you could imagine. It just concentrates some flavors, and it never really becomes a pretty mushroom, but slice that sucker up and fry it. Oh, man, it's one of my favorites.
The common name for them where I grew up is ram's head. That's what everybody calls them, is a ram's head. And they kind of have that same thing with like the hen. It's got that like woolly looking thing. But there's a restaurant down in Fort Worth run by Tim Love called Lonesome Dove. And they do a dish there that's basically an Americanized version of a very famous Scandinavian dish. That's the Scandinavians like, I think they use chanterelles and they use reindeer loin and whatnot. And what Tim's done with it, he uses an elk loin, and then he uses the matakis as the mushroom to kind of like mirror the Scandinavian dish. And they cook those super crispy, and they're freaking amazing. They're absolutely freaking amazing. Let's take a couple more questions, though, and we'll get you out of here before I have my internet flake out again. Other Kevin says, would mixing plants in a tent help with the oxygen? I think the problem with that is you're introducing microbes that you don't want in your tent.
The problem with that, generally speaking, is the spores get on the plants and get in the soil, and it kind of becomes an issue over time. Mushrooms use a lot of oxygen. The plant cycle where they use some oxygen at night and more carbon dioxide during the day. And a lot of people try to do that in the marijuana industry because they want high CO2 levels and all that. And I just kind of stay away from it. It wouldn't be a horrible idea on a small scale, but it's never worked out large scale.
Okay. But it's kind of the opposite of what I thought. I was more afraid of the microbes in the soils invading your grow medium. But I guess by the time it goes in there, it's so colonized, like the competition level is like, what's left for, you know, you're contaminated at that point, especially like oysters, they're aggressive as shit.
Once you're fully colonized, your chances of contamination are slim to none.
Pretty damn low. Jane says, which is the easiest to grow first try? I would say pinks and blues. Oysters.
Pinks and whites. White actually is a more temperature variant mushroom. Okay. The elm oyster, they call it, is just a plain white oyster, and it grows from 50 degrees all the way up to like 85, 90.
Yeah.
It is the honey badger of all mushrooms. I always tell people that elm oyster is the honey badger of all, easiest to grow, hands down. Blues are a little bit harder. They won't be as blue because it's not as cold as in my grow room per se, you know, so, but you know, and the pinks, super aggressive, easy to grow. Yellow's a little bit harder, but not much. On a scale of 1 to 10, I would say oysters are the easiest. Then you start, I mean, calling 10 the easiest. Then you start getting into your lion's mane is probably a 8, 9. And then below that, you know, maybe a 7, it'd be your kings. You know, 8, 9 to be your Pilipina also.
Yeah.
And then you get down to 5, 6 is probably chestnut. I mean, to have consistent success with. And then you get down to your fives is, you know, your kings and whatnot. And then you get to maitake is probably a four, you know, on the scale of how easy it is to grow. Shiitake is pretty easy to grow, but to have high yields is ridiculously difficult.
I think one of the reasons the oysters are so easy is because they're fast. It's not just quick gratification. Like, the faster something is, the less time there is for something to go wrong. So, like, pink is, like, when I do one of these jars with pink, holy crap, I'm afraid it's going to come out of the jar and eat me. I mean, it is, like, you put the stem in it, and you were mentioning using cardboard, and I read about that. So what I do, I use AeroPress to make my coffee. And the beauty of that, for those that, if you want to try the AeroPress and grow mushrooms, the moisture content of those grinds after you press it out with that AeroPress is about perfect. So as long as you don't let it dry out further, it is ready to go. Well, each one of them also has this little disc of a coffee filter. And you buy like a box this big that's got like 500 of them in it for, I think it's like $5. So they're less than a penny a piece. But every time you pop one out of that press, you get the little disc with it too. So when I first do stems, I put them in the bottom of the sanitized jar, and then I pull out with tongs about five of those coffee filters, and I throw like maybe 2 tablespoons of the grinds on the top and put the lid on the jar. And the lid, my lids just have a small hole drilled with a step bit, and then I use 2 layers of that first aid tape. That's what I'm doing. I know that's very low-tech. It's not, you know, super bad, but it works. And then once it colonizes that, then I add more coffee. And like I said, like a blue, like this will take, that takes like 2 weeks to do that. Freaking pink. 2 days in and there's like little wisps of mycelium on the top of the coffee. And where I've, when I first tried to do it, I got a lot of like blue mold and shit. And what it was is I would throw all those stems down there and I would almost completely fill that jar with the coffee and it just couldn't move fast enough. So I think a big part of why oysters are easy is because they mitigate, like I can half ass it and have it work 99% of the time. Where if I was trying to do that with something more complicated and slower growing, I would get a lot more, you know, green molds and blue molds and shit like that.
I love that you, it's just a one little thing you do every day, you know, or every other day.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You get a little prep work and then a little bit of here, a little bit there. And that fits my ADD personality. I can run around, do a little this, little that, little this, little this, little that. And I get something amazing as an end result.
Yeah. That's like, that's my next blue one right there. And you can see that there's still a pretty big gap right there where it hasn't colonized yet. But I also on this side of it, I don't know if the camera can pick that up, but there's cotton fuzz up all the way to the top. So this one probably tomorrow, you know, I'll go ahead and fill it the rest of the way up. And so it's probably, once you get a jar going like this, it's probably once every 3 days you're adding to it. And by the time you've done that 3 or 4 times, it's full. And then it's ready to do something else with, because I actually have tried fruiting this and it does work, but the yield is dog shit. And the way I tried it 2 different ways. One was just pull the, let it fruit through the hole. And the other was remove the lid and set it in the Martha tent, and you get like one big mushroom and that's it. And just by taking the time to put it into like a 6-7 pound block, you get a, you know what you get. You get a much bigger yield. All right, man. Well, you want to tell people about your website and what have you?
Sun Valley Harvest. Not a very mushroom related name, but why change it at this point? We're on, you know, we have a WordPress site, Sun Valley Harvest at WordPress, and then, Instagram and Facebook. And you can go on Instagram, see pictures of the grow room, stuff that we cook with. I try to do a reel or, you know, something every now and then. See us at the farmer's market. You can kind of see the way our booth is set up, all the different products we got. We do medicinals, tinctures, the whole nine.
Okay. Cool. Cool. But you don't ship product. Do you?
Well, I was really interested in doing grow kits for you, but man, shipping grow kits in Phoenix in the summer is just, you know, I'd be replacing more and losing money. But all of our dried products, all of our tinctures, our seasoning mixes with mushrooms in them. You know, we do French mustard and I grow chilies in the garden, grind them up and make like a chili mix and stuff like that. So, and then tinctures, we do a lot of medicinal stuff. We use only fruiting bodies. And you know, all made here at home. You can see the pictures of us making them on Facebook or on Instagram, you know. So we're not some big company that's ordering a bunch of crap out of China and
trying to,
jump on the bandwagon. You know what I mean? We do some coffee mixes, but, I usually steer people towards our medicinal mix to mix in with their coffees. You know what I mean?
So, real quick then, maybe, final thought then, do you want to maybe give people some advice that are thinking about taking it to the next level as a small business? Not everybody needs to be a North Spore with their staff page of like 25 people on it or something like that. And, you know, you're doing most of your business, I think, locally. And I think there's, it's an interesting space because, like, you know, you mentioned microgreens, like I said on your notes, but like if you have a guy that's roped off the restaurants in an area with microgreens and you move in and try to like compete, it's almost like mafia shit. Like there's like this animosity, you know. I remember John Dowdy saying, them guys were coming up with my restaurants trying to take over my chefs. I ain't letting that happen. And you know, he's as Massachusetts sounding as it gets. It was hysterical. But what I found with mushroom people is it's more like, come on, let's go. Like more of us is better for all of us.
I find it pretty frustrating when a new vendor shows up at the farmer's market because then we're just kind of splitting.
Yeah, I got that.
You know, what could be made on a Saturday.
Yeah.
But as far as the amount of mushroom farms, I think that there's enough growth in this industry. I mean, look at the United States compared to other countries and how much per capita of mushrooms is eaten is a pittance. I think the growth is here in the United States, especially as people are, you know, with more health conscious people trying to eat better foods. The local food movements is amazing now. So yeah, I think there's a lot of growth in the United States and I'd like to see a lot more mushroom farms. You know, whether it be my scale, which, you know, or small scale commercial, which we've got, you know, some of those in Arizona now, all the way up to the big guys like Monterey Mushrooms and Kennett Square in Pennsylvania grows a ton of mushrooms, you know.
Yeah.
Tons and tons of mushrooms, as well as, you know, Chinese imports. There's some great products coming out of China, but you know, local food is always a little bit better.
Yeah. And I think there's a huge market there to be tapped into because if you're going to be truly small scale, like how many customers do you really need? If you're selling to your average customer, let's say once a week, like that for a small scale person, there's a ceiling on like, I don't want anymore because I can't keep up after a certain point. And then I'm doing less for my others. I also see it like fitting really well into if I wanted to increase our business on farm business, which I don't. We just basically sell duck eggs. But I could easily put an adjacent product in with like, you know, this customer is good for 4 dozen eggs every 2 weeks. I guarantee I could sell them a clamshell of 2 different oyster mushrooms. And I think that maybe for a lot of people that want to see this as a additional revenue stream, it would make more sense for them as an adjunctive product than just all I do is mushrooms. Or it's the first product and then you build out kind of a portfolio.
And I another thing about mushrooms is you can dry them and you can make value added products.
Yeah.
And you're not, you know, you take a 1,000 tomatoes to the farmer's market and sell, you know, a couple hundred of them, you know, you got 800 pounds of tomatoes that you gotta, I guess you can make tomato sauce, but that's a lot of work.
Yeah.
Whereas with mushrooms, you just put them out on a table, put a fan on them. And next week you sell them like that or, you know, and dried mushrooms are amazing. I mean, it kind of concentrates the flavor.
Powder, sell them as instant mushroom stock. It's just the same powder in a different bag with a different label on it. Cause I do that all the time. All my cutoffs, ones that go a little bit long. And I'm like, I don't feel like eating that now. And I know you could just leave what you said, but I have an Excalibur. I throw them in there and in like 4 hours, they're like completely dry. Cause they kind of,
we put a packet on it, put a label on it, call it mushroom gravy.
Yeah, mushroom gravy. But what I do, I just make powder out of it. And I use it as flavoring in stocks and stews and stuff. And it's awesome. It brings that umami The other thing,
right on a steak. Well,
I was just gonna say that because it's basically it's natural MSG basically, and like dusting a steak right before you sear it. Holy crap, that flavor bomb that it adds, and shiitake stems are crap, honestly, to eat as stems, and they make beautiful stock. I mean, that's another like little thing you could do there. Anyway, Kevin, this has been cool, man. Thanks for joining us today.
That's been great hanging out with you.
So, folks, real quick before Kevin leaves, I will have all his links in the audio notes, down in the video notes. If you click the link, you can get on over there. If you do it right now while we're still live, it won't work. We're not quite done yet. But if you're watching the replay, that link down there will get you everything. If you are driving or something like that and listening to this and want to check Kevin's stuff out, just go by the website, thesurvivalpodcast.com. Look up episode 3721, and no matter how far in the future it is, it'll still be here, and you can find all of Kevin's good stuff. So, Kevin, man, thanks for joining us today. All right, guys, real quick, let me wrap up before the internet flakes out on me again. I just want to remind you guys about my book, Laws of Life, Ditch the System, Design Your Life. I am kind of really grateful to all of you folks that this book's still selling every day. And I know we're starting to sell to people that don't know who Jack Spirko is and don't know what the Survival Podcast is. But, you know, when we're still selling 6 to 8 books a day, every day, like clockwork, I know that's a lot of you guys. And I'm just going to ask you to keep on doing it, man. The more we sell, the more exposure we get on Amazon, the more people we can bring into the fold. And I think this would be a great book for those young people in your life. Thad Beckendorf, who is one of the youngest first sergeants in the United States Army, told me after he read my book, I wish when I was a drill sergeant that every young man and woman that was going to come in under my tutelage had read this book before they joined the military, because half of them would have done better and half of them probably would have joined. And there's not even that much about the military in there, but it is about how to adapt to life. Check it out. And if you want to know how a guy like me, as flawed as I am, managed to get so many things done in my life, it is the principles espoused in this book. Also, you can support us by doing your online shopping starting at tspaz.com, T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. No matter what you buy, if you start there, you help us out. I am once again running the Olatin's T-O-5-8 folding scalpel. This thing is just awesome. It's actually great for doing work with your mushrooms. The T-O-1-0, which is the smaller little brother, is also really good for, you know, getting that stuff out of the stems of those oyster mushrooms. But this is just, it's basically a little super lightweight 1.6-ounce titanium pocket knife that uses a replaceable number 60 surgical blade. What I like about those surgical blades is every veterinarian, every medical office, every hospital, every doctor's office uses surgical blades. That means there's a massive economy of scale. These things are super cheap. They're like, you know, 50 cents a blade or something like that to swap out. And you always have that super razor sharp blade. And the number 60 blade of surgical blades is the one that is going to give you that longest cutting edge. And this is like, I sent a video of this to Ken Berry yesterday. I said, it's a doctor's knife. There's actually a type of knife called a doctor's knife. This takes that to a new level, carries super easy, super light. You can find it at tspaz.com or thesurvivalpodcast.com and scroll down. But remember, as long as you start your shopping there, you help us out no matter what it is that you eventually buy. And then last but not least, we are about to, when I get back from vacation, launch class 002 of the ChatGPT for Solopreneurs course, Become Dangerous with ChatGPT. That is going to go on sale, I believe it's the 8th. It's the Monday after I come back. It'll be the first Monday that I'm back. It's the second Monday of, let me be sure, so I'm not just talking out of my butt here. It will be September the 8th, Monday the 8th, that we will put that on sale at 9 o'clock in the morning. Just like the first round, you have got to be pre-registered and on the email list, and I'm going to send an email out. And then, this is almost a joke, those people get a 24-hour head start. There isn't a 24-hour head start. The last time we did this, y'all broke the site. There was so much demand for it. I think Tom's got that fixed, so that won't happen again. But we still sold out in 2 minutes. 2 minutes of people yelling at each other in the chat and stuff like that. That will happen again. We have raised the price. We did the first round as a test at $100. $300 was always what I thought the course was at least worth. every student that took the first round said, yeah, absolutely, it's worth it. We had zero student complaints. So Tom and I feel good now that we've been through class one, going to class two, charging the full price, so it'll be $300. But if you're trying to build a business and you want to take your business to another level, this is the way to do it, and the demand is clearly there for it. But we have over 700 people pre-registered already, and we're selling 100 seats per round because that's what Tom and I feel that we can legitimately support through this 40-day cycle. It takes some work from your instructors to do a good job for you. And so I'm only leaving the registration form up next week. After next week, I'm shutting it off, and then we'll have that break. And when I come back from vacation, we'll go ahead and put it on sale. So if you are not yet on the registration, you want to get on the registration, just go by the site or go to jackslaws.com, and you'll see the advertisement way up at the top for this course, and you can fill out that form. Please understand, filling out that form does not mean you're in the course. It means that you will get an email at 9 o'clock in the morning on September 8th, and if you're ready and you click the link, you'll probably get a seat in the class. I kind of hate to tell people no, but Tom and I can't manage this course with 200 people in it. We just can't. We have to have a cutoff, and 100 is the cutoff that we came at. We're going to run this about, you know, every 3 months, so about four times a year until there's not demand for it anymore. The other thing, though, we already have a private forum set up, and every class has access to all the classes going forward, because at that point, that student is actually supportive and can help. But if we enhance, if we add something, if we bring something new, they still have access to it. The private forum allows for a network of entrepreneurs that have been through this training. That's probably worth more than the training, and the training is probably worth $1,000, and we're selling for $300. And I'm not going to apologize for saying it's worth $1,000. That number comes from students who have said it's worth at least $1,000. I think that puts it out of most people's price range. $300 seems fair to me. If you want to end the course, please do so. That will take us out for today. And I will catch you guys tomorrow with an expert counsel Q&A show for the week. Just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.